miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps thrive on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Revolution Radio, it's Saturday, and it's time for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show with your host, Scorpio. Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Let me pour another.
Hello, and welcome to Operation Scorpio. Today's date is Saturday, October 24, 2020. And welcome to the free-range, open-air, and insane asylum we call Earth. Well, guys, here we are on the big countdown until the election, right? Oh, boy. Only 9 days and counting until the big event. Yeah. And it seems like we're going to kind of just be in a holding pattern, right, with the agenda and everything. I think things are just going to stay very, you know, flat until this election comes. And then, look out, guys. It's going to get real strange real quickly after this election, I think. You know, kind of round and round it goes. Where it stops, nobody knows. And, you know, it's kind of hard to know how much credence to put in this election, you know. It's hard to say about the election because no matter who wins, especially if Trump wins, this, you know, this might be the last election that we see as we know it. You know, we're going to hear, oh, the system is broken and we need comprehensive reforms. Remember that? Obama was always saying that. We need comprehensive reform on this and that and the other thing. And of course, that's just a code for a good old-fashioned screwing, right? Yeah, that was kind of Obama's mantra for everything, wasn't it? Yeah, comprehensive reform. That's what we need. Because the election, this system just isn't working anymore, guys. And we're going to hear a lot of calls about that real quickly, I think. Yeah. So one thing's for sure, though, we are living history right now. And, you know, there's no question in my mind, this is the most important event that we're going to live through in our entire lives. And maybe our children's lives as well. And, you know, this is also the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on humanity. And make no mistake about that. We are in the big one, the big kahuna of bullshit. I mean, there's just more deception and misdirection at every turn since the beginning of this emergency. And, you know, I was looking over, you know, last week it was reported that the CDC essentially admitted that they had not isolated the coronavirus. And if you look through, you know, I kind of did a little research and started looking through the papers associated with that statement and what specifically was said. And one thing that's clear is that they admit that they've only found parts of this virus. Like they don't have the complete sequencing of it. What they did is they had pieces of it, then they put it into a computer, and the computer did the sequencing, which I guess is how they do it, but it was all done with incomplete material. So I don't see how you can say, well, we've isolated the virus. We know what it is. It's kind of like these computer models that they use with global warming. And then the other thing that was just astounding to me, absolutely astounding, is that the final results were achieved through consensus. So there was a panel of scientists, right? And they made the final decision about what the sequencing is, right? So we have science through consensus now. It's science, right? No, it's not science because, you know, even I know to be science, it has to be replicatable through independent sources. Independent sources. That means anyone can replicate the results that has some kind of a laboratory. But apparently that has not happened. Instead, it was decided by consensus, much like global warming. The science is settled. Leading scientists have said, right? Oh, okay, it's settled. Yeah, so anyway, the deception continues, right? And yeah, last week on my show, you know, I made mention of a story about this kind of young kid, well, young man, 19-year-old, you know, young man. Seems like a kid to me now. Back in my day. Yeah. Well, so this young kid, he was 19 years old. And, you know, the assistant for the maestro, you know, building a guest house on my property, right? And so I had to tell this kid, look, you know, you can't work here with a mask. There's no masks on this property. So if you want to work here all day, you're going to have to take your mask off. And, you know, he took off his mask. And, you know, the maestro knew it was all bullshit too. But here's the epilogue to the story, right? So the next day, the kid didn't show up to work, right? Didn't show up. So a couple more days goes by, and I asked him, the maestro, well, what happened? You know, what happened to your assistant? And he said, well, he's working this other job where he can wear a mask while he works all day in the hot equatorial sun doing construction work. Okay, well, I guess we have to make our own choices, but just how much common sense does it take to think that that might not be a good idea for your overall health, right? Well, guess what? Yesterday morning, the maestro comes and said, you know, that kid that you said couldn't work without a mask, well, he is home sick after working like 3 days at this other job site without a mask. I mean, with a mask, sorry, with a mask. So he worked 3 days in the hot sun with his mask on to protect himself, and now he's sick. He's at home sick and can't work. And he probably thinks he caught COVID virus. I don't know. I didn't ask that part. But here is sort of just, you know, anecdotal proof that wearing a mask, especially if you're doing, you know, hard labor, you know, construction work's hard work, man. You do that all day with a mask, it's going to make you sick. And, you know, I was thinking about this too. Like, have they ever done a scientific study of, you know, what happens to people if they wear a mask all day long while they're working for like, oh, a year or 2 years long? Have they ever done a scientific study about that? Well, the answer is no. No, they have not. So one way to look at it is, at the very least, you know, we're living through sort of a mass experimentation on people's health worldwide. You know, an experiment never attempted before. That's at the very least. Right? Because how many brain cells does it take to figure out that, you know, wearing a mask all day, it's going to be really bad for you? And I was thinking about this morning. You know, it's kind of like putting a petri dish over your face, right? And just let this, whatever happens to grow in that petri dish is going to be on your mask. And I don't know if you guys remember, but like back in high school, in science class, we did an experiment in biology one time where you have a petri dish, right? And you just breathe on it, you know, take a couple of breaths on the petri dish and then close the cover up and see what happens in the next couple of days. And, you know, within 2 or 3 days, there's just all this funky stuff growing on the petri dish that was previously sterilized. So that's basically what you have over your face. So, you know, and it's like we're kind of like, you know, biological machines in a way. So when we exhale, it's a lot more than just CO2. You know, there's all kinds of other waste products that are coming out in your breath that it has been decided that you were supposed to get rid of by the whoever created this body that we live in. So it's not just CO2. And this is a mass experiment at the very least. And of course, anyone that thinks about it very long is going to conclude that this is very, very unhealthy, especially if it goes on for, you know, years, as I think they plan on trying to do. And, God, you know, yesterday I had to go to the dentist and suffer through a couple of procedures. It wasn't that bad, but, you know, when I was in the office talking to the lady and, you know, paying for the treatment, of course, you know, I couldn't help myself. I told her, I said, well, do you have any fear of this virus? I don't. I know it's all a scam and, you know, those masks, they're a joke, aren't they? Isn't this just ridiculous what we're going through right now? And, she goes, yeah, you're right. You're right. It's absolutely a scam. I don't have any fear of it. And, but you know, if I hadn't been the one to bring it up, of course the subject never would have been broached. But once people are comfortable and know it's okay to talk about it, suddenly they open up real fast. And it was kind of interesting. She also told me, oh, I'm really into chlorine dioxide. Maybe you guys, some of you guys have heard of that. And it's supposed to be really good to help oxygenate your body. So I've heard a couple of people that I know talk about it and just rave about the effects of it. So she's going to get me some, and I'm going to use myself as a guinea pig and see what happens. Yeah. And, you know, this is kind of interesting. I was talking with this lady a couple of days ago, and she pointed out something to me that's actually really obvious, but I just never thought of it, or at least not recently. You know, she said that, you know, government literally means mind control, literally, in Latin. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I never even thought of that. Duh. Right? Yeah, because governe, mente, governe is control or, you know, govern, and mente is mind. And even in Spanish, mente is mind, and governe is like to govern or to control. So that's exactly, all they did is drop the E, because in mente, it, to mean mind is M-E-N-T-E. So anyway, that literally means mind control. Duh, I never thought of that, but it's so obviously true. Of course, a lot of things are obvious once they're pointed out to you, you know. Yeah. So I don't know about this election, guys. This is some weird times are coming on this one, man. I don't know what to make of it, you know. I mean, I kind of try to look at it from the point of view of the conspirators. And if you look at it from that point of view, the way to go is a Harris win. Oh, I mean, a Biden win. Yes, a Biden win. Because that way, if the Dems take the House and the Senate, then, you know, blah, 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 there's no resistance and they have control of all three branches and yep, yep, yep. But, yeah. But, you know, really, I don't see how in a fair and honest election, I don't see how Biden could possibly win. Especially if you watched any of that election, it was just complete and utter destruction on the point of Biden, man. I mean, he just got destroyed the entire event. And there was a couple of times toward the end where Trump was really giving him the 1-2 punch. And, you know, he started to look kind of confused, like he had that kind of blank stare, you know. And it was pretty bad. It looked pretty bad, you know. At least from my eyes, Trump controlled himself, didn't look angry or mean. He wasn't a meanie. Yeah. especially with this scandal. You know, I know it's been covered ad nauseum. I'm sure you guys have already heard about the Biden scandal. But, you know, what I find so amazing about it is that what's happening with this event now is that the mainstream media is essentially officially announcing the death of investigative journalism. I mean, they're just coming right out and admitting we are no longer journalists. We don't research anything. We don't look into anything. And, you know, the two big cover stories now are, the Russians did it. Oh, the Russians. And the other one, which is even more shameful in a lot of ways, is that they're saying it can't be verified. We can't verify this information, so we're not going to report on it. Oh, right. It can't be verified, but like, isn't that your job to verify it? Right. So how hard can it be? Get out there and verify it. Do some digging. You know, look into this thing. But no, we can't verify it. End of story. So we're not going to report on it. Nothing to see here, folks. Please continue shopping. Yeah. Of course, now you can't even do that. Please stay in your home. Yeah. So they're just coming right out and saying it now, man. It's out in the open. And now the media and the government have this really cozy, symbiotic relationship with the government. You know, the media and the government are sleeping together. And they're rubbing each other's backs and washing each other's hands. Yeah. Well, of course, it should be the opposite. You know, it should be very contentious and adversarial, but no more. And I was thinking back on this too. You know, when it really started to get kind of obsequious between the media and government was during the Gulf War. Because remember, they had all those embedded reporters and they just sort of, you know, said what they were supposed to say about, you know, what the military advisors told them to say about what was happening. And it was all very cozy and warm and friendly. Never a word of like, should we be doing this? Is this in the national interest to have this war in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else they try to get things going? You know, that was never asked. Never. Very cozy. So that was back in the, well, I guess, you know, it was that way in the first Gulf War, and then the second one even more so. So by the early 2000s, late 90s, it was really getting cozy between the two groups. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Basement 5 in the chat rooms talking about Jeffrey Toobin. Oh, man. Yeah, the list of pervs keeps growing, doesn't it? Yeah, that's, he didn't know he was on camera though. He just thought he'd just have a quick wank while he was doing a Zoom meeting. Nothing unusual about that. Perfectly normal. In fact, we can't allow Mr. Toobin to lose his job. You know, it might lead to another Holocaust and anti-Semitism. So, and plus he has such a great mind. We can't allow to lose that. No, he's special. Nothing wrong with what he did. We'll bring them back in 6 months after a little cooling off period. Yeah. Yeah. So the cover up for Groper Joe is unbelievable. And of course, I think it's a lot bigger than just to protect Groper Joe. Because, you know, America has been for sale for a long time. And if you think about it, if you just have capitalism without any kind of, moral code or moral behavior or societal agreements that are agreed upon by everyone involved, well, why shouldn't the government be for sale? Everything's for sale, right? We're just here to make money. That's all that matters. Yeah. So why not sell the government? And so, China's been buying up every military and industrial secret that wasn't nailed down to the floor since the Clinton era. What was it, Chinagate back during the Clinton regime? Chinagate, down the memory hole. Didn't happen. Right. So, yeah, man, I walked down into town And I ran into that Army Ranger guy again that I was talking with, and he kind of mapped out this scenario more. He's certain we're going to war in the next couple months. And, you know, this guy's certainly eccentric. You know, well, I'm eccentric too, but he's eccentric in a different way. You know, he eats like a dozen hard-boiled eggs a day and has a pistol with him wherever he goes, you know. So this guy is serious, you know. He's not a joker. And he served in combat and stuff, so he knows a lot about the military. But he was saying that, you know, he kind of mapped it out more, and like the whole Orient is going to be in play in this scenario that he believes is on the verge of happening. So like China's going to try to take Japan and settle some old scores there, right? A lot of animosity historically between the two countries. And that the Russians will support them in that because a lot of animosity historically between Japan and Russia, too. And then, you know, all the islands are going to be in play, of course. Hong Kong, Taiwan. China's going to invade and occupy those. And even Australia will be in play, according to this guy. Because, you know, Australia already sold most of its mineral rights to China. So China can just say, hey, we have a contract. These minerals are ours. And we're, by the way, while we're at it, we're going to go ahead and occupy a lot of property where there's minerals. Yeah, who knows, man? He was pretty convincing. I mean, I don't know if he's right, but, you know, he was saying Iran, Russia is going to side with China. And, oh, also, this is kind of interesting. He said that everyone's going to gang up against Israel now because Israel is going to be in play because all the Arab countries are going to want to move on Israel once, you know, all the fighting starts and everything's kind of in chaos. So we'll see. It was an interesting scenario and it was pretty convincing too, I have to say. So yeah, I thought, you know, the debate was good. Trump did really good, but one thing that, you know, bothered me, he keeps talking about using the military to distribute vaccines. He said it again at the debate. And I'm just thinking to myself, well, why do we need the military to distribute vaccines? I mean, what we're talking about here is just a bunch of little vials, like millions of little vials, which don't take up that much space. And millions of syringes. So why do we need the military? I mean, that's not, it doesn't sound like that difficult a thing to do if that's what you really want to do. And of course, using the military, somehow there's an implication of force because it's not like the military is going to be driving around giving out vaccines without guns. You know, they're going to have their guns, their pistols, machine guns and, you know, whatever else they bring with them. So, yeah, I don't know, man. That's kind of strange. I don't see why he keeps going back to that. But part of what I see is that, you know, no matter who's elected, this agenda is going forward. Of course, Trump will do things, I think, to try to slow it down. But if you look at it, it's expanded very rapidly. So I don't know. There's only so much he can do. But what I'm seeing, though, is like they're acclimating people to just, you know, oh, if we have a problem, well, just use the military. It's normal, you know, and they're really just acclimating us towards that. And if you start noticing in news footage, you'll see a lot of, you know, news footage where there's just like some military guy just standing in the background for no reason. Like, well, what's that guy doing in camos back there with the machine gun over his shoulder? And, of course, you know, we're having to use the National Guard to quell some of these riots that are happening, right? More guys in camos with machine guns or semi-auto machine guns. So I just see this sort of thing where they're just sort of getting us used to seeing more and more guys in military outfits doing stuff for civilians. And, you know, these field hospitals, these emergency field hospitals they're building, I guess the newest one's in Wisconsin. And again, they're all staffed by what do they call them? Field medics. Yeah, field medics and other military guys. So this, everyone there has either got a white coat on or a camo outfit on. Of course, they're devoid of patience. Never mind that part. Like at the one in New York City at the Javits Center. That was pretty much devoid of patience, but lots of guys with camos walking around. And, you know, that one guy, I think his name was, Lincoln Kareem. He just set up his camera for hours in front of that thing and zoom in, zoom out. And a couple of times an ambulance would pull up and they'd open up the back and it'd be an empty stretcher with a couple of boxes of stuff on top of the stretcher. And they'd bring it in, and then later they'd bring out another one with some more crap in it. But no sign of any patients coming or going. But lots of military guys walking around. And then, of course, if you look on the news, too, when they're at the food distribution centers, lots of guys in camos handing out the food to the people, the long line of people. So yeah, lots of people in white coats and lots of people in military gear, and then lots of people with full-on biohazard gear. That's what we're getting acclimated to seeing and, of course, normalized. Yeah, so I think part of the reason they're doing that is, you know, when the shit hits the fan, whenever they make the big move to switch to the new system, there's going to have to be military people stationed all over the place worldwide, right? I don't think there's any other options to pull this off. And that's why they're trying to delegitimize the police. Oh, the police suck, but hey, these guys with the blue helmets, they're really nice and they're here to help. But, you know, there's not enough UN troops to do the job. They have to use National Guard and other military forces, and they're going to have to do it worldwide. Worldwide. I don't think there's any other options because it's going to be unpopular amongst a huge swath of the population what's coming. And, you know, we've crossed the Rubicon, and there's no turning back. These guys have got to keep pushing forward. We've come way too far to not keep going. Yeah, so those were some of the things on my mind this week. And that said, I'd like to bring on Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Giuseppe, how are you, sir?
Oh, it's been a long week, but I'm doing well. It's always awesome to join your show and see all the... You have quite a fascinating and dedicated following in the chat room. Basement 5, Fearin, Sinter, Pat Rabbit, Morpheus, Snippets, Troy Boy, Open Philosopher, Comet, Mer Bailey, Stardust Man, it goes on and on. And they're such bright people. It's really fascinating that there is an audience for this type of show, which is certainly not the obsequious mainstream fodder that is everywhere else.
And we have 33 chatters by coincidence right now too.
Yeah, man, it's a great intro. Really, nailed it all. I mean, to me, it's always been the plan to get some type of physical World War III, because that is ultimately the Great Reset. They cannot possibly leave any morsels of the Zionist bubble economy where they have stole so much money, probably hundreds of trillions, if not millions of trillions of dollars from the average citizens of this world with their bubble scams and their you name it. The kosher casino, Wall Street, is the best example. And especially when you factor in that whole Deagle report that the great Jim Fetzer always likes to reference. But, you know, what's interesting is he just talks about the United States population being slashed by 2/3. But I looked through that whole study, and it essentially also slashes Canada, Great Britain, Israel, anyone who's a puppet ally of the Zionist leadership is decimated. So that's what they're predicting is a world war, that the countries under the sway of the great parasite are destroyed, basically. And what's interesting is we have Greg Felton coming on next hour, the brilliant author of The Host and the Parasite, who can discuss just such matters.
Right on. Well, let me ask you, you brought up the Deagle report. How much credence do you put in this as something legitimate? I mean, a lot of people have referenced it, but what kind of credence do you put into it?
Well, Deagle is their business is they are, what would you call it, consultants to the armaments industry. And they know what's going on with present military capacity, future military capacity, weapons, and then they sell that knowledge. You know, they're a specialty consulting firm. So I actually put some credence in what they say. I think they did it for shock value, to draw people. How much free publicity are they getting? You know, it's comparable in my mind, in my twisted mind, to what Neil Ferguson did with that outlying doom and gloom report for the so-called Corona 19 virus. So I think Deagle, you know, whipped up 20 scenarios, and that was one of the most heinous, but they put that out because they knew that it would draw them amazing amounts of free publicity.
Right, right. Good point. Yeah, and I guess Britain goes from like 65 million to 15 million. Which,
yeah,
Israel
drops.
But
Israel's
wiped out. How would
up.
They accomplish it? I think there's only two ways this could happen. It'd either be through a nuclear war or some kind of for real, you know, depopulation event through, you know, some kind of bio warfare of some kind. I mean, I don't know what other scenarios could lead to that kind of death count.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the obvious scenario is Israel creates a hot war with Iran. Russia backs Israel. Russia backs Iran. We back Israel. And then all of a sudden it gets going, and then China sees its chance. But China sides up with Iran and Israel because of the whole BRICS thing. I'm sorry, Iran and Russia. And that's how that happens. You know, it's funny. There's two ways to look at it. There's people like Mr. Rowe who claim that I've heard him say on his show and on the High Council report on late Wednesday, early Thursday morning with Joe Tones and Hijacker, that the U.S. military armaments are so sophisticated, so above what everybody else has, that what people think are UFOs are just America showing off. Hey, my eye's listening. Hi, my eye. That's over on the video part of it.
YouTube. Oh, right on.
That we're just going along and making all this money, but we're so vastly superior. And you know what? It's possible, but I kind of doubt it. Having had my wife work with the Beltway Bandits for the last 10 years and have her uncle have a high position in Raytheon. So over the years, I've heard what it's like in this place. And I don't think we have such an amazing advantage. In fact, I tend to believe people who say Russia has done nothing but create just amazingly debilitating weapons that could wipe out the U.S. easily, and we've messed around with the flawed F-35. So I tend to lean on a gradient. I tend to lean more towards that scenario where if we ever got in a hot war, Russia could release a couple of things and wipe out 2/3 of our population. But you never know. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This guy, this Army Ranger guy I talked to, he says China is going to take Japan and settle some old scores. And but that and North Korea and South Korea getting into it is going to be what's going to trigger it, and that the whole Orient is going to be in play. But what do you think of a scenario like that? That's pretty out there, but he was convincing when he was talking to me, you know?
Well, I would like to see that guy naked except for wearing a sidearm peeling his hard-boiled eggs. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, with a 3-day shadow too, you know,
and staring you in the eye and not blinking, and being able to flawlessly peel that egg, and continue with a intense conversation. To me, that's
well, and this guy's a trip, man, because he eats 12 eggs a day, but he also he's always hiking, man. This guy does some serious hiking. Like we have some big mountains here, and he climbs up these mountains all the time, and. Brings a whole bunch of eggs with him. I mean, that's how he spends his days, you know. So,
do the Ecuadorian? Is he older guy or?
Yeah, he's retired Army Ranger dude, man.
Do the locals in Ecuador call him Tio Sulfur?
Ringo Loco.
Because he brings the sulfur storms if he's eating a half dozen boiled eggs.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I've never gone on a hike with him. but I might someday. He's an interesting character. And, I always like talking to ex-military guys because they have experiences that, you know, the average civilian doesn't see. And I like to pick their brain and see what they say. You know, my eldest uncle was, UDT, underwater demolition team in Korea. So he told me some far out stuff that kind of got me started on this path. Now he used to point out he got into academics after the military, and he used to tell me how many professors at the university that he was at were actually CIA agents, you know, like worked for the CIA and were just in, you know, cover. Their cover was being a professor at the university.
Yeah, you know, there's so much of that, and the deep state is far more omnipresent than anybody. The spook side of that, you know, the financial side, they have their private CIA and such, but the intelligence side that's tied more to the government, they are everywhere, man. People have no idea how bad it really is. You know, they use this treaty from a decade or so ago, the Five Eye Treaty, to get around the CIA's ability to spy on Americans. How do they do that? Well, they just have the Australians and the British and the New Zealanders spy on us constantly, as we do for Britons and Australians to get around their laws. It's so insane. And and it's so, my wife worked on a project and she's got clearance way above top secret, can't tell me anything. The one thing one time she said is that these people on the internet who are all paranoid about how much they're being watched, they have no idea. So it's bad. Interesting. It's really bad.
Yeah. So we'll see, man. It's just everything's in such a weird place right now. And, you know, I keep having this feeling that something really big is just around the corner within the next few months myself. It's just like an intuitive feeling I've been getting.
Totally.
Have you been feeling a kind of strange
thing? It all blew up eight months ago when they launched this massive fear pandemic, this scamdemic of turning the common coronavirus, which is the cold, the common cold. It's everywhere. It's in every mammal. It's in every reptile. And that's the new nano terrorist. And, you know, you start digging a little bit. And as everyone knows, we've said this, Bill Gates is a psychopath. He's been propped up. He's a Satanist. And he's been propped up for 10 years to be the new vaccine global messiah. And then you look at the backup with that Rockefeller Foundation report outlining the Operation Lockstep, which we're now living. And so the energy is so different that, you know, when we interviewed David Icke last week, he said the hidden hand is now in the room. And the door is closed, so we have an opportunity because they're all in, as I said to him. That's the fact, but they're also insanely evil and powerful. And, you know, the only strategy we have is we have to, like your Army Ranger, instead of boiling the eggs, we need to wipe out, literally murder, hunt, and remove from this planet all of the globalists. There's only about 20,000-30,000 of them. And, you know, to have a peaceful world with decent nationalist countries, sovereign nationalist countries, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And I would like to see that omelet. And so right now they've identified themselves and they need to be taken off the chessboard, as they say. You know,
we got to make a 12-egg omelet, right?
Right. Yeah. So do people have the courage to do that? We'll see, right?
Yeah.
You know, everybody talks about everybody. Well, people who are awake talk about, you know, oh, well, you know, Jim Fetzer, there's 130 million Americans with guns. If they, you know, people, the average person with guns isn't going to stand a chance. We need the professionals. We need the former SEALs, the former Rangers, the former who can go up against the private security of the Rothschilds, of the Rockefellers, of Dick Cheney, who is a traitor and a murderer and should be hanged or shot in the head. And so we need professionals to step up and do this for us. Those are the people who break the eggs and make the omelet. And then the next challenge would be there's so many opportunists and scum who will say they're with you. And then we all of a sudden we get the Who song, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. So I don't know. I'm a little cynical about the whole thing, unfortunately. I mean, of course, I'm fighting it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. And entering, because this is the final stand. This is truly good versus evil. But, you know, I look around and I see the millions of shitheads who obediently wear these masks, who obediently destroy their health. And now this so-called second wave is nothing more than people making themselves sick for the last 6 months wearing those ridiculous masks, those garbage masks that aren't science at all, but they're the science of slave training. That's what it is, the science of slave training. And so now these weak
minded. That's well said. Well said.
Yeah. So anyway, that's
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just saying I really like that phrase you just used. That's excellent.
Well, it is the science of slave training. And the sadly, there's nothing more offensive than these Soros color revolution idiots, these politically correct modern people, these soccer moms and these go along to get along dads and Bruce Springsteen, who's going to move to Australia if Trump wins. And it's like, my God, I mean, I am no fan of Trump. He is utterly controlled by the Zionists, but if you think that President Kamala Harris, the Luciferian philatrix, is going to make a good president, you are out of your flipping mind.
That's a good one. Another good one, Giuseppe. Yeah. People in the chat room are talking about chickens and free range eggs and stuff. Have you ever had chickens, Giuseppe?
Oh, of course. I wherever we live, we track down organic farmers and we buy direct. It's delicious. Yeah.
No. I mean, have you ever had like your own chickens? Have you ever?
Oh, no. I'm a city boy. I mean, when we lived in New Mexico, we lived rurally. But no, I'm a city boy. That would be something to have your own animals. I would become too attached to them. I could never kill them.
Yeah, that is a problem for me, to be honest. I have egg layers. My chickens are for eggs, not for meat. But, you know, it comes a point you're supposed to, you know, take them out. But, you know, what's interesting is that chickens are a lot more intelligent than people think. You know, the scientists always say, oh, they have a little tiny brain the size of a pea or something like that. But, you know, they're very smart in their own way. And they do have their own culture too. They have a pecking order, as they say, and they you know, certain chickens like to hang out with each other, and other ones kind of group up. You know, they have kind of friends, you know, and it's kind of funny. And also, chickens live in a rape culture, Giuseppe, just so you know.
Yeah, I am familiar with that. It's pretty wild, and they all have every sentient being, even insects, they all have personalities and they all respond to love. It's just more proof that we are animated. What the heck? Why is
Well, the roosters don't ask. They just do what they do, and it's over pretty fast, and then they go on with things. So chickens are interesting, man, and they know how to find bugs, and they spend the whole day looking around for stuff to eat, and then they take a little nap, and then, you know, I don't know. Chickens are interesting, man. I've learned a lot from watching the chickens. I never thought I would, but they're very interesting creatures.
It's amazing. And you know, I mean, you know, nature is nature. There's a food chain. But what's so fascinating about, you know, the arrogance of humans to think they're above nature, and that really came from the indoctrination of the ridiculous belief that the bipolar, mentally ill Abraham, you know, God was talking to him, and that's where the three religions come from, Judaism, Christianity, and Muslim come from. And, you know, there's a million paths to heaven, as I'm paraphrasing some mystic. But the point is you can become a very decent human, a spiritually awake and enlightened person through any paradigm, but unfortunately most people don't use that as a foundation to find your own enlightenment. Instead, they become rote repeaters of the dogma, and they judge you, and it becomes like a sports team. I'm a Catholic, so, you know, you Jews or you Muslims, you know, you're my enemy. And and it's just, and all of that, the idea that's infected, it's like a cancer, the arrogance of the human sentient mind to think that we're above nature, where in reality the only way, I mean, we're already well on our way to the sixth mass extinction event that's going to destroy all life because of that arrogance, because of our unwillingness to show real wisdom and to show real, to be a shepherd of nature, to create a scenario where we live in harmony with nature. But that's where the satanic evil, the Talmudic Jew, the globalist, the Satanists are literally, their real goal is that shooting war, is that decimationist planet, to create this mass destruction of everything. So the post-apocalyptic dystopian remains allow for that type of demonic entity to enter the physical world. And so that's what they're going for, and it could happen. I hope not. I'm fighting it, but
yeah, let's hope not. Yeah, you're painting a hijackarian picture here for us right now, Giuseppe.
Well, yeah, it's
is that a word?
It is now. It's a pretty good one. It's been a long week, so I'm weary. And so when I get weary, I become a little darker and more cynical. And it just seems to me, with all these shitheads, and last night about 1 a.m, I finally got done with all Fetzer stuff and everything, and creating the animations for your show today with Greg Felton. And my wife got a text from her lifelong friend. Her parents were in the Foreign Service in the 80s, and she lived in East Berlin as a little girl. And the U.S. government didn't acknowledge that East Berlin and the wall existed, so they'd have to go to school. They'd live in East Berlin and go to school in West Berlin, and she met a childhood friend then. They've been friends for their whole life. This woman was married to a guy, and he was jealous that she made more money than him. So now she's a single mom, and she's really a good mom and a great artist, and like yourself. And last night she texted that her two sons, which are about like age 12 and 9 or something, tested supposedly positive for COVID, right? For Corona.
Uh-oh.
And now they're what is that? What's the word? Isolated. It's quarantine. They're quarantined. They're doing the whole
self-isolation.
Contact tracing bullshit. And she's freaked out by it. And I just became enraged. And as you well know from our guests, such as Dr. Judy Mikovits and the many others, this is all a scam. This is all a lie to gain control by the handful of those Satanists. And so this is all happening together. The last 8 months, you're talking about your intuitive sense, man. It's totally happening. This is ridiculous. It's offensive. And I was waiting for one of our circle of friends for this to happen to somebody. And now it is. And it's just, I am incensed by this.
Well, let me ask you this. Are they asymptomatic, or are they actually, do they have the sniffles?
Yeah, they're asymptomatic. It's like you wear these masks all year. They're really good athletes. They play soccer and hockey and all this stuff up there. They're in the Boston area. And the weather's changing. And for 6,000 years, Oriental medicine has known, natural medicine has known that when the seasons change, people get sick. It's just how the body reacts. It wears on the immune function, especially if you go from hot and humid to cool and dry. And so that's all this is. It's so insane. It's so absolutely evil. And now, I'm getting a blow by blow, and it's just,
Wow.
Wow is right. Yeah.
And what's amazing is they're not even sick, but they plug some, did they take the nasal raping treatment, or is that what they did?
I mean, I'm sure that's how they tested them. That's the test.
Right. But the reality is there's nothing wrong with them. They could just go on living their lives, but no, now they have to stay in their house for 2 weeks. And where did they live nearby you, or this is in Virginia?
No, this is up in Boston. We're outside the District of Criminals. They're up in the Boston area. And yeah, of course, they all get nasal rape to go to school. That's the new normal for those poor young. Can you imagine? This is what it's doing to their psyche, these young, impressionable kids, 9, 10, 5, 12, and all of a sudden they're living this wartime bullshit where they're essentially prisoners of COVID war. And, wear a mask. We're going to nasal rape you. We're going to make you sit over there. Don't have fun. Don't take that mask off. It's like we're living the Pink Floyd album, The Wall.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. The other day I went to one of the parks here that's, has all the, little equipment for the kids to play on, right? So I just peeked in there and looked at what was going on. And there was like maybe 7 or 8 little kids in there, all of them wearing a mask, playing, on the slide and the jungle gym and all that kind of stuff, wearing a mask. And it was just incredibly sad. And it's hard. You're right. It's hard to fathom the kind of damage, the mental slave training that's going on with these kids with wearing a mask. And they intend to keep this going for at least another year with the masking, and that'll start to normalize it. With enough time, any weird behavior can become normalized if enough people do it.
Exactly right. That is the key point. And look at how quickly the average normie, I'm scared. I don't want to die. I don't want my kids to die. How quickly they put those masks on. Even since day one, I've never worn a mask. I keep telling people, and more, intrepid researchers are pointing out the real science that they're worthless, but they don't want to hear it. They're like, I don't want to die. I'm going to wear a mask. I'm going to get the Bill Gates shot. I don't want to die. It's so cowardly, so weak-willed, so weak-minded, such a lack of being, having a spine. It makes me sick.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And also, I agree, you know, there you sort of vacillate in how, you know, optimistic you are about things. You know, some days it's easy to go pretty dark because you just see all these bad signs, like, you know, hearing about them putting up plexiglass windows everywhere at grocery stores and building these igloos or, you know, plastic bubbles for people to eat their dinner in at a restaurant, you know. I mean, it's just disturbing, and it's like, why are people putting up with this? You're going to flush our entire lives down the toilet because you're afraid? Is that what's really going to happen? It's amazing.
Exactly, man. My eye is putting up some great stuff. I just put up this one. When I was ranting, where I said there's a million paths to heaven, he goes, he quoted Rumi. I love Rumi. And
yeah.
I read his quotes all the time. In every religion there is love, yet love have no religion. That's exactly it.
The that's
divine
awesome,
love.
Man.
Yeah, that's really good.
Great comment.
And then this one, he's the art of medicine consists in amusing the patient while nature cures the disease. Voltaire. Yep.
Wow, that's heavy.
Yeah, man, he whatever drugs he's taking, keep taking them, my eye. Yeah, that's really good, man. He's clearly a wise man. That's cool.
Right on, man. Well, we've only got just a little bit before the top of the hour, and so we're going to bring on Greg Felton here in just a few minutes. What are your thoughts on that right now?
Well, here we go. I'll save it till after.
Okay. All righty. Good deal. We will be right back, guys. Stay tuned for Greg Felton. Okay. We are back for hour number two of Operation Scorpio. I am here with Giuseppe, and we've been having a conversation about this crazy world we live in. Giuseppe, were you able to reach our guest?
I believe Greg Felton. Oh, it just said unavailable. I just messaged him via Skype to say that we're trying to call you. Please answer. So let's keep trying.
Okay.
And go ahead, and I'll keep trying to add
him. Sure. Yeah. Well, I don't know, man. This is all. We really are in uncharted territory right now with this world, and you know, and I can totally see what you're saying about your friend. You know. Just seeing them go through this and buying into the propaganda and the fear and actually shutting their lives down and, you know, giving legitimacy to this situation now with the COVID crisis. It's disturbing, you know, and it's funny how I was talking with this lady the other day, and she's very well informed, an expat down here. And she said, you know, some people are going to defend this to the very end, even as you know, we see the agenda unveiled all the way and where we're really going with this. She said some people are going to defend this to their last breath, you know, and I think that is true. It's like my cousin that's a nurse in San Diego. She's admitted to me several times that there's nobody in the hospital with COVID. Place is a ghost town, essentially, but she still believes that this is all real, and I'm crazy, I'm a nut, and they're just waiting for that big surge of people to come in. It's going to happen any day now.
Well, what's ridiculous, Scorpio, is you mentioned Wisconsin, and what actually is going on there is there's supposedly a big outbreak, you know, in the northern part of Wisconsin, where Green Bay is in the two-thirds of the way up to the north, and then farther up north towards the Canadian border. It's supposed to just be this massive outbreak. So there's a hospital up there, a mid-sized hospital, Brown County. That's Brown County is where Green Bay is, the Green Bay Packers, and it's not a large hospital. It's a mid-sized at best. So you figure they've got maybe 24, 36 beds that they could dedicate. And their emergency room in intensive care is probably, what, 16 beds mass? And so they're making this big deal. Number one, people wore those masks, and that's what's making them sick in combination, as I mentioned in hour one, with the seasonal change. This is when people start to get sick. And when you're under constant anxiety, your cortisol levels are through the roof because of this fear and this worry about, oh my God, I don't want to get the nanoterrorist. And, right. And so that's why people are getting sick. So they're like, oh my God, it's a COVID-19 second wave. No, it's not. And so what they have is, you know, flu, pneumonia, comorbidities, people who already were pretty ill with heart failure or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. They got a cold now and it's bad. And so that hospital's full. So they make it seem like, oh my God, it's ground zero. So down the road, about 90 minutes, is the permanent Wisconsin State Fairgrounds. It's in West Allis, Wisconsin. West Allis is the little working class suburb right next to Milwaukee. Okay. So they have a permanent big fairground convention center. And now they're hello, is this Greg?
It is.
Hey, Greg. All welcome, right. Man. That was nutty. But hey, I'm glad you're here. Got to say, you know, I want to get my Admiration Society stuff out of the way. I've heard many of your talks and interviews. I own your book, The Host and the Parasite. Read it multiple times when I got it about 2 years ago or 1 year ago. It kind of blurs. But hey, glad you're on the show. There's so much to talk about. So first off, how are you and how are you handling this insane fear-demic?
Well, what I'm doing fine. I'm not ill. The whole family is fine. Because of the nature of my work, I'm actually not very severely affected by it. I teach, so I can teach either over the internet or I can teach in person. So I think I'm lucky that I'm not as hard done by as most people. As far as the epidemic goes, the pandemic, I am not quite certain how much of it is overreaction and how much of it is legitimate concern. There is, I think, an attitudinal problem. The people are, I think, falling into lockstep a little bit too easily. And I do think a lot of the mask wearing is overdone. But I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm not really in a position to argue. Although I am writing a book on the coronavirus, and I should have it finished by next month. It looks at the man-made nature of it.
Interesting.
And whether or not it is a bioweapon. I can state for a certainty that this is not a natural virus.
Right.
Yeah. Greg, this is Dave Scorpio. Really good to have you on the show. Maybe you could say a little bit more about this book you're working on. Is there any other things you want to share about it?
Well, it's the virus itself can be seen to be the result of something called gain of function research, which is a rather fancy way of saying you're going to juice a natural virus to make it even more infectious, even right. more lethal, and even more transmissible to humans. And that does sound like a rather perverted thing to want to do. And that's basically my position on it. However, the standard defense is that, well, if we make these ever so contagious and virulent, we can find a vaccine for it. So just in case this really happens, will be prepared, which sounds just a bit like giving a squad of pyromaniacs a bunch of flamethrowers and torches to burn yeah. them, just so you can train the fire department in case it really happens. So it doesn't sound very reasonable. And so I've got a lot, I've actually done, I don't want to get too much into the nuts and bolts of it, because it gets a little bit specific when you get into talking about genetics and the spike proteins on the virus and how that affects the cells. And but I can tell from the structure of from studying the structure of the virus that it is absolutely not natural.
Well, I really look forward to reading this book, because one of the things that became obvious in The Host and the Parasite reading is that your skill set of being a teacher, being an extremely bright man, but also a meticulous disciplined researcher, is that you're digging into the nuts and bolts in a trained way that most people do not have the ability to do. So I really look forward to reading this book when it comes out. And to validate your point, are you aware of how Dr. Luc Montagnier, the man who was awarded the Nobel Prize because he discovered the RNA snippet of the human immunovirus, HIV, and he went on the record several months ago as saying that this is absolutely man-made, altered, and if anybody can prove him wrong, he'll give back his Nobel Prize. And so, yeah, something's going on. And add to the other thing that I'd like to get your thoughts on was the brilliant metaphor of the pyromaniacs. And because of the 1986 Act here in America, they're indemnified. If they burn everything down, they can't be sued. It's insane. We've created this artificial environment where essentially criminal activities can be obscenely rewarded with profit.
Yeah, that's the problem with laws. I mean, laws are only as good as the people who make them. And yeah, I really feel so sorry for Americans because, you know, nominally they live in a democracy in some sort of Republican state, but really they live in an autocracy. It's almost like a police state. And Americans live in the illusion that, hey, this is the country from 1787 when James Madison helped put together the Constitution, yada, yada, yada. Well, it isn't really. It's actually mutated like a virus. I mean, the United States took into the healthy body politic of America the Zioni virus from Israel.
Yeah.
And essentially, that mutated the genetic structure of America. My God, that's a wonderful metaphor.
That's really good. Yeah, yeah.
And so this is why Americans, you know, they look at the superficial reality, the world of appearances. And it doesn't correspond to the reality. So a lot of people are mistakenly, are still deluded by the illusion of democracy, by having elections, by having a Senate and a Congress and a Supreme Court and an indirectly elected president. But really, the people who run the show are the people who have the money and the power to take control of the political apparatus and make it serve their purposes. You know, this is not a unique to the 20th century, even the late, the early 21st century, but it's become so much more obvious that it's becoming almost impossible to take seriously the notion that Americans have any say in what goes on in their own country. And it's really quite lamentable. And by the way, about Luc Montagnier, yes, I have read him, and I've read many other people. And I've got some wonderful bits about the censorship of the mainstream press toward the artificial nature of the virus. But that's something that's going to come out probably next month, or maybe just before Christmas.
Oh, boy, good timing.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you're saying about, you know, this just an illusion of democracy. There's no question about that. And, you know, one thing, you know, we're seeing an agenda that's being unveiled and enacted over at least over the last 30 years. And I always go back to the NAFTA treaty that, you know, George H.W. Bush was working on. And then as soon as Clinton gets elected, the first thing he does is finish up NAFTA and get it passed. And, you know, that was his primary goal. So it was a real bipartisan effort to enact this globalist, policy that really destroyed and wiped out so many working class jobs in the United States.
Well, the thing with the NAFTA treaty, we had the same problem up here in Canada. And I think a lot of our problems go back to the election of Ronald Reagan, who was the first I would say at the time the least qualified man to be in the White House. See, he was put into the White House by the Christian right. I mean, Jerry Falwell, remember him?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah, his son now has got himself in a serious problem. Falwell boasted that it was Christians who put Reagan in the White House. And the tragedy of it all is that he was quite right. It was the Christians. And when Ronald Reagan came in, as I say in my book, he came into the White House with a sense of Christian rectitude, but not much else. And Reagan, he ended up turning America away from being a democracy to being almost a quasi, how can I put this, a quasi-authoritarian regime. He didn't understand government. He didn't understand economics. He only understood his own general biases. So this is why we ended up having things ultimately like NAFTA, which was called the Free Trade Agreement, the FTA, when it was first concocted. And we had a prime minister up here who was basically cut from the same right-wing cloth as Reagan. His name was Brian Mulroney.
I remember Brian.
Yeah, and he was, yeah, I guess you could say conservative, but the word conservative doesn't have the same meaning as it did when it, you know, when it applied to people like John Quincy Adams or up here, John Diefenbaker or Arthur Meehan. So it didn't have the same effect. But what it did was it essentially turned back the clock on any of the progressive reforms that had been enacted during the 1960s. And if you want to know a little bit of interesting history, in the early 1970s, there's a man named Lewis Powell. He would become a Supreme Court justice. He would be appointed by Nixon. And Powell was the former chief lawyer for Imperial Tobacco, that wonderful company. And he saw what was happening in the United States, and that the Kennedy-Johnson Great Society movement was gaining such traction and was being so effective. He warned certain big corporations that unless they got their act together, they would never have the influence they used to have. So beginning around 1973, throughout the 70s, the right wing, the corporatocracy of America, staged a counter-revolution to all intents and purposes. And it mounted an attack on populist and democratic thought and institutions. This is where we have the Heritage Foundation, the first think tank, the first of the right-wing groups that would end up controlling public policy and influencing both Democrats and Republicans to the point where there's no difference.
Man, that's an excellent point. The Powell Memorandum is so pivotal, and hardly anyone knows it exists. Thank you for bringing that up.
Well, I was glad to do it, because I found this actually quite by accident during my research. You find things you don't expect to find. And this is one of the gems that I came up with. Because that explains an awful lot about how corporations ended up dominating to a much larger degree than they ever had the political structure of the United States. And they ended up becoming the norm. I mean, they sort of normalized America. America became generally a support mechanism for corporate profit. And if you look at the Democratic Party, and I use that term loosely, it's pretty much sort of like a watered-down Republican Party.
Right.
Two sides of the same autocratic coin.
And yeah. You could say vice versa, too.
It is. I mean, if you look at what happened in the 2016 election, I mean, it didn't really have an election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You had two institutions, the Republicans and the Democrats, going after each other. And they all agreed to play by the same rule book, largely. I mean, they're both owned by corporations. They're both largely anti-corporate tax. I mean, the Democrats are slightly different, but not that much. They're both pro-Israel, which means they're both treasonous. So we had a situation
in the 2020
election where you had a the party, the Democratic establishment, had to put up a candidate that it could be sure it wouldn't upset the apple cart. The last thing the Democrats wanted to do was ensure that Bernie Sanders got elected and through his progressive policies undermined the corporate foundation that gives the Democrats its power base. I mean, we could have had a really good presidential candidate, but it's more important for the Democratic establishment to preserve their privileges and their corporate friendship than to do right by the American public. So today we have essentially a one-party state that differs little from that of Soviet Russia. We kind of split it in half and pretend it's two parties. And so this is one of the problems with the United States, is that beginning with Reagan, we ended up on what I call the slippery slope to neo-fascism. Now, that might sound like an unfortunately exaggerated term, and it might turn a few people off, but it's actually true.
Right. You know what's interesting, Greg, is I'd like to get your thoughts on the idea that back around 110 years ago or so, the pioneering mind manipulation work of Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, really helped corporations influence the lifestyle and purchase habits of Americans. And it then via the Powell Memorandum, they realized they could go farther and pretty much influence government thinking. And so now it is a fascist state, neo-fascist state. There's no way around it.
Well, actually, I've talked about Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, again, you're right, he was Freud's nephew. And he is the father of the term public relations.
Right, right.
He's the guy who realized that you could sell anything if you did it the right way. And one of the first things he did was give women the right to smoke.
Right.
And because of that, women now have an equal opportunity to get lung cancer.
Torches of Liberty.
Torches of Liberty. Well done. Talking to a very educated American. This is really good. Yes, it's Torches of Liberty, and that caught on, and that's how Bernays used public relations stunts and other devices to manipulate people. And he was unapologetic about it. One of the worst.
Yes, he was. And of course, then this goes on to metastasize into he worked for the CIA, essentially, and helped foment revolutions in South America and found ways to influence the populace for government. So it got even worse than just selling products.
Yeah, he actually misled President Eisenhower into thinking that Jacobo Arbenz, the president of Guatemala, was a communist.
Right.
In fact, he was a liberal Democrat. He just wanted better wages for Guatemalan workers. But United Fruit Growers, which was the real authority in Guatemala, got Bernays to propagandize Arbenz as a communist because fruit growers don't want to pay a living wage. Eisenhower made an error. The Marines were sent in, overthrew Arbenz, and put in a nasty dictator, which is what America always likes, because American nasty dictators are good for business, bad for people, but good for business. And that's good for America.
Yeah. Very interesting.
It's amazing how little people really understand about the world around them, because so much of it is filtered through a propaganda lens. If you're aware that you're being lied to or being manipulated by an advertisement, you're okay because you know what you're up against. But if you don't know you're being manipulated, you're a victim, and you're exactly the kind of person corporate America loves.
Well, Greg, how insane is it that people get more, the average American gets more excited about the Super Bowl commercials coming than the game?
A, they're very well produced. I have to say they're extremely effective, entertaining commercials. And I despise advertising, but I have to admit I do appreciate art. And people like it because they know they're going to get a quick hit, maybe 30 seconds or even less now, of a very effective bit of propaganda. And according to neuroscientists, people who are easily entertained need a hit of humor or a stimulation every 6 seconds.
Wow.
So the stimulation you get from a commercial is more rapid fire than a football match. So people look forward to commercials because I think Americans generally like commercials.
And I think they do.
It's like a mini show.
Yeah, absolutely. What's amazing that I noticed beginning, especially in America, about the 1980s, the early 80s, with this whole greed is good thing, as they started to put like radical phrases like, fight. I'm paraphrasing. These aren't actual phrases because I didn't. This is off the top of my head, but things like fight the power and take down the man kind of thing. But they put it in like Levi jeans commercials and Budweiser beer commercials. So they totally neuter the drive of young people to make actual societal change. Instead, their great statement is to, yeah, man, I'm going to take down the man. I'm going to buy a pair of Levi jeans. It's so insidious that they take over the mind of the unaware at so many levels.
That's quite true. And the truth about media. Now, Americans are proud of the First Amendment to the Constitution, and they're proud of having a free press. But if you look at the purpose of the press, and this is not unique to the United States, it's pretty much the way it's always been, but in the United States, it's, I think, a little bit more pronounced, that the press is not so much an information medium to enlighten the electorate so they can make informed decisions. It's a behavior modification mechanism that's being run by essentially an elaborate psychiatric or psychological enterprise called the American government.
Oh, well stated.
Absolutely. And look what they're doing now with a 24/7 COVID hysteria. Let's just take a wrecking ball to Western civilization because we're afraid, and let's wipe out all the small businesses and just so everybody will be safe. And it's just a nonstop symphony of fear right now.
It is, although I can be quite honest.
Okay, Greg, we're at the bottom of the hour break here. So just hold on to that thought and we'll be right back. Okay, we are back. We're midway through the show already. It's whipping by. Greg, why don't you go ahead and finish up with your thoughts that you were sharing before the bottom of the hour break?
Yeah, as far as the lockdown, the economic lockdown, I've been reading both sides of the issue, and it is a little bit bizarre. However, I've also been noticing that in the United States, especially with Trump's political rallies, people are leaving them severely infected by the virus. So I have to think that too many people in a closed space is not a good thing. And that's
well, wait, where are you getting that from, well, that people are being infected at his events?
Well, people are leaving his, like, for example, the Tulsa rally he had. And there are a number of what are, I guess what they were called, they were like, I forget the term they used, but there are these great contagion event.
A super spreader event.
That's right. Thank you very much. Super spreader. So I have to take at face value the notion that a lot of people in the small place is not a good thing. So perhaps I can understand why people would want to keep people at home and not go out. Although I need to see a lot more information about how the SARS virus spread. So I take an agnostic position on this. I don't think that it helps a lot to argue that, because a lot of the reaction to it is emotional. And when you have people who are emotionally invested in self-preservation and they look at mask wearing and staying home from work as perhaps a necessary preventative measures, they're not going to be amenable to discussion or argument. So a lot of the reaction is, I think, emotional. And
well, but wouldn't you take into account that the mainstream media is potentially lying to us about the figures and how many sick people there really are? I mean, this seems to me to be such a massive agenda to totally reshape society and take a wrecking ball to our entire Western civilization right now.
Well, that's possible, but you've also, there's a problem with that, because if you say that, that means you assume that there is this agenda to begin with, and you're looking at the evidence that supports the agenda. I don't know whether that's the right way to look at it. As far as taking a wrecking ball, then you'd have to say, well, why? I mean, for example, there's an argument that says that the Chinese deliberately released the COVID-19, the SARS virus, to undermine Western civilization or something. Dr. Yan Li Meng is a whistleblower who has been very outspoken in her understanding of the virus, and she is featured quite prominently toward the end of my book. She argues that this was deliberately released, but I don't know if I could defend that, because I would have to ask myself, well, why was it released at this time? The Chinese didn't have in place a good propaganda campaign to defend it. I mean, they had some ways to explain the virus. They said, well, it came from this market of the Hainan market, not far from the Wuhan lab. There's a secondary lab, a satellite lab, not far from the market. And then I thought, well, okay, but that was debunked. But then Dr. Shizheng Li, who is the head virologist for coronaviruses in China, came up with, as the head of a report, saying, wow, we found this virus called RATG13, and this is the common origin of SARS virus. So it is natural origin. But it can be shown that RATG13 doesn't exist. It was fabricated completely out of whole cloth to give the illusion that it was a natural virus. So you've got to wonder, the Chinese are smart people. If they wanted to start a war over this virus, you would think that they would have a better command of propaganda than to throw up these desperate third-rate attempts at explaining a natural origin that were easily debunkable. It was terrible. It didn't have the same sort of propaganda effect that the World Trade Center and Pentagon bombing had. I mean, that, you know, looking back, it was utterly inept. But the propagandists on September the 11th, 2001, managed to sell a false story, and it had everybody in place to do it. There was none of that anywhere with the SARS virus coming out of China. So I don't think it was deliberate. So I don't know whether we can say that this was an attempt to take down Western civilization or it has anything to do with it. I think that might be a little bit extreme.
But Greg,
I have to do a little bit more research into the Chinese at the time. Because something like this, it's very hard to prove.
I mean, right.
People's instincts might lead them in a certain direction, and I can understand how that it works. But it ends up at a dead end, because unless you're able to find any specific evidence for it, it's not supportable.
Because yes, let's say we don't know the intention here, but the result is we're seeing our society destroyed. And if this goes on for another year, like they're saying at the Davos World Economic Forum and other places, wearing a mask is going to become normalized, and you're not going to see much left of small businesses.
Well, yes, that is probably quite true. This is something that needs to be investigated thoroughly. And as you mentioned at the top of the show, that my research is quite thorough. I do check and double check all my sources, and I take a lot of time to research. My current book has, I don't know how many pages of foot and end notes that are based on medical journals, articles, interviews. So I would have to do a little bit more investigating. And I might well come around to your point of view. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that there's not enough evidence to sustain it. At this point, I would say it's a good supposition. But, I mean, a lot of people I talk to go on about the Rothschild family and how they're responsible for the creation of Israel. That Israel is simply a Rothschild banking empire project. And I kind of roll my eyes because you don't really know that. I mean, you can think that, but you can't prove that. And besides which, it's not necessary. I mean, Israel is based upon a fraudulent understanding of Jewish history to begin with, or at least Hebraic history. And there's a lot of problems with that thinking. So I try to, if I believe something, and I think it, even if it's controversial, I've got to have something to hang on to. I've got to have that smoking gun, or at least a shell casing from a gun. And I don't have that yet with respect to the notion that this is a deliberate, malicious, willful destruction of Western society. That may, in fact, be the effect of it. But whether it's an intentional or unintentional effect, I can't prove.
So you're a true journalist by the old school standards. You like to have independent, verifiable sources. My God, man. That's rarity these days.
Well, I think it is rare. When you see a lot of journalists, or so-called journalists, they'll write stories that say, it appears that, or sources say. They use a lot of weasel words. And this is really, really disturbing. And there's a great report. I won't say great. That's a bit of an extreme report. In 2015, the Hudson Institute, which is one of the right-wing propaganda factories, that turns out right-wing direct that, among other things, thinks that Social Security should be defunded and that corporate taxes should be eliminated. They came out with a report about the virus, about the need for researching viruses in the name of biosecurity. Although how you can have a virus and use it in a defensive manner, I really have no idea.
Right.
But they say something like, the State Department assesses that, say, Syria or Iran or something has biological weapons. But assesses? I mean, is that the best you can do? I mean, if you haven't got the evidence, you can't say it. You can't say allegedly. You can't say we think that or we believe that. Belief doesn't matter. But damn, you've got to have the evidence. And this is when Colin Powell gets up in front of the United Nations Security Council and lies through his teeth. I thought, Afghanistan having these, I don't know what they call it, aluminum tubes that were going to be used for some sort of weapon of mass destruction. And that propaganda put out by Judith Miller, largely, was used to justify the destruction of Afghanistan. He get up there and lied, and he didn't say anything definitive. He used weasel words to sort of protect him in case he was caught lying. I mean, the whole purpose of journalism is to lie and not get caught. That's the tragedy of it all. So if you can prove something, great. I'd love to see, even if it completely challenges my frame of reference. I want my frame of reference challenged.
Because if so much that we're taught is deliberately deceitful. You know, the statement by William Colby that our mission will be complete when we've made Americans think that everything that they believe, when it's everything they believe is a complete lie, and that's a paraphrase, of course.
Oh, I know.
But we do live in an ocean of lies right now.
I know that quotation. That's really good. He was right. This is the tragedy of the press is that we don't really know what's going on except what the government or the press wants us to think is going on, which is why, you know, everybody should study Edward Bernays.
Edward Bernays was a genius in a certain way. I mean, kind of an evil genius, but, you know, this collusion between the media and government, I really started to see it in earnest, of course, it started before this, but during the second Gulf War, when we had all these embedded reporters within the military, basically just parroting, you know, a very rosy view of the war and everything's going great. And we're doing this for freedom and the American way and so on and so forth. And it just seemed like, you know, during that time, the relationship got awfully cozy. And of course, thanks to the, you know, the Clintons during their reign, they deregulated all of the media, allowing a few corporations to buy everything up. And of course, Colin Powell's son was the head of the FCC at the time to help grease the skids there.
Mm. Yeah, this is the, see, with Ronald Reagan, one of the things he did in his first 2 years was he took the controls off the banking industry, which made it possible for banks to violate the very rules that were set up by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to preserve the country from another stock market crash, which happened really because a bunch of wealthy people treated the stock market like a casino.
Right.
And so what happened in 2007, 2008? Well, we had another crash. So you had Reagan essentially deregulating the banking industry, and then Bill Clinton later on repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the great protection that Americans had for their own for their banking system. This is why you had banks getting back involved in investment gambling, which is how you ended up with all of these bad debts, where you had Clinton, you had Bush or W and Obama bailing out the banks. They didn't have the guts to let them fail, which they should have. And then they should, I mean, now if the public bails out the banks as they did, doesn't mean the public owns the banks. You got to think, aren't these now public banks that should be run for the public interest? I mean, who the hell?
That's absolutely true. And, you know, we let these banks get away with such bad behavior, and then we bailed them out and there was no consequences. So it's just human nature. The behavior is only going to get worse.
Yeah, it is going to get worse. And as I say, I'd like to see the America get reform itself, but I'm finding it very difficult to see any way that such an infected, sick body, the body politic, can reform itself. I mean, the Israelis really own the United States. I mean, America is Israel's bitch. Let's not be too polite about it. America is nothing that Israel won't allow it to do. And when Obama did stand up in some way to the great imperial master sitting in Tel Aviv, the emperor got his knickers in a twist, came over here to Congress at the invitation of the kiss asses like John Boehner, and basically read the Riot Act as miscreant satrap.
That's right.
Yeah. I thought it was funny that Trump gave the key to the White House to Netanyahu recently as though he didn't already have it, you know.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, the emperor wants to be thought of as a nice person. I mean, the thing is, this is what Trump... really, it disturbs me about Trump. I mean, he was elected. Actually, to be quite honest, he wasn't really elected. I mean, you could have run a chipmunk in the Republican Party, and he probably would have won. Because what I call the Trumpublicans, not the Republicans, but the Trumpublicans ran in such a way that the public did not want to elect Hillary Clinton. This was a rejection of Clinton. It was not a vote for Trump, because even her own John Podesta, her own campaign manager, knew that she was woefully disliked by the average American worker because she had no use for them. She was contemptuous of them. She was a banker's senator, and she admitted as much. She gives speeches to Goldman Sachs, and she basically kisses their ass, and they support her. And it was a collusion. It was grossly unethical. There's a conflict of interest here. And a lot of Americans sensed this, so they voted for this amateurish TV host with a terrible business record. And they put him in the White House, not because they wanted him, but because he wasn't a politician. Remember, Trump stepped over the corpses of more than a dozen professional senators, congressmen, governors, even a few outsiders. You have the ridiculous, pathetic examples of Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz masquerading as a politician instead of a sock puppet for big oil or big weaponry. And he walked over them. He won. It was one of the most bizarre primaries I've ever seen. And yet, here's an amateur who gets elected precisely because he's an amateur. That's it. And he gets into power, and of course, he basically screws everything up. I mean, he comes into power pledging to drain the swamp of the very people that got America wrapped up in these endless wars of aggression that end up killing Americans, destroying American reputations, and destroying everything. They serve no purpose. What does he do? He bombs Syria twice in successive Aprils. He appoints a nut job to be the American ambassador to Israel. His son-in-law, a Zionist of the worst order, ends up becoming a de facto president because Trump can't be bothered to read the bills he's supposed to sign. Government by Kushner. Now, that wasn't what Americans voted for, but because Trump is so lazy, I mean, this is what we get.
Well, I think the real reason that Trump was elected, and I agree totally, it was a reaction against Hillary Clinton because she's such a loathsome elitist character. But I think it was also a reaction against globalism. More and more people were seeing that, hey, we're getting screwed by these trade deals and, allowing, the government to spend so much money on foreign interests. That's at least what he promised. That was what he brought up. And sort of trying to stop this flow of illegal immigration. Those were the things that I think got him into office. Now, whether or not he's been successful at doing any of that is a very different story.
Yeah, as far as globalism goes, I think that applies to a certain segment of America. But I don't think Americans really have that much of a worldly understanding of politics. I mean, a lot of Americans, I see from the way the election went, they vote their gut. And they vote the person. I don't think there's a lot of thinking about grand geopolitical themes here. So, I mean, if you look at...
I didn't mean that so much as just the concept of, hey, let's put our country first and stop meddling in other countries so much and try to fix what's wrong with this country. There's so many problems in the United States, and I think, that was the reaction I was kind of pointing out.
Trump allegedly was going to do, like as I when I wrote a couple of articles about this, about you have a buffoon or a psychopath. That's the choice that Americans have. And Clinton was, because of her role in the destruction of Libya, and she was actually an unindicted war criminal. And a lot of people were furious that America was doing these things and causing. Now, attacking a country like Libya just because Muammar Gaddafi wanted a better life for his people and wanted Africa to stand on its own two feet instead of being a subordinate continent to European business, he was taken out in the most disgusting manner. His whole country was destroyed. Even though Libya had the highest standard of living, one of the highest standards of living in Africa, it was destroyed because it was... the corporate world decided it was time. And Clinton, because she's a corporate schmuck, she went along with it. And Obama didn't have the courage to stand up to him. This is why I blame Obama for being a bit of a wuss. He should have said no and put her in her place. But I get the impression that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State because she was Israel's watcher in the government. And this is, why I think... America went into Libya for no reason other than to destroy a country that was going to be a success, and that success would have would have affected the bottom line of corporations and possibly Israel. So Clinton was not electable. She was an unelectable candidate, and this is what the Democratic Party knew. However, in order to protect her reputation, the reputation of the party, from the inevitable loss that she was going to suffer, and they knew she was going to lose, they invented this ridiculous Russian hacking story. And this was concocted back before the election was finished. Because you had to have some way to explain how Hillary Clinton could have lost an election that was essentially fixed for her. The media was on her side. The Democratic Party sabotaged her progressive opponents in the party. This was a rigged election. And it's one of the most amazing examples of screw you from the American public that they didn't buy into it. So
that's true. And, you know, the DNC even admitted when they were challenged in court on some of these things, they said, hey, look, we're a private corporation and we can do what we want. We don't have to follow any so-called election rules. And they came right out and said it in court. So they didn't even deny it.
Yeah. And this is what, you know, they get away with that, too. And so back in the 1920s, of course, you remember this was the decade, I think, was 20s. When corporations successfully sued to become treated as persons under the law.
Right.
And this is really why there's a lot of severe, serious problems in the United States. Because we have created a political legal framework in which the average citizen has fewer rights than a corporation. And that the public is essentially a glorified ranch of cattle to be slaughtered in the name of profit.
Yeah, and don't forget that, what was it, about 25, 30 years ago, the Scalia helped define the Supreme Court that money is free speech. I mean, how absurd is that?
It is disgusting. It is revolting. And yet Scalia, appointed by Reagan, was unfit for office because he is a Christian nut job. The man he was probably the most offensive Supreme Court justice ever appointed. Now, Clarence Thomas is an idiot. I don't have any use for Thomas. But Scalia was influential and dangerous. And that is truly, truly upsetting that somebody like that could get appointed. But only a Christian president like Reagan would have appointed him. And because of that, he had this decades upon decades of largely right-wing justices essentially mangling the Constitution to support corporations and the privately held and the wealthiest Americans, which is really disturbing. The Citizens United decision was unconstitutional because the Constitution
absolutely
corporations as people. It's we the people, not we the undersigned corporation declare
that this team. Right, right. Greg, we're at the top of the hour already, and so just hold on for a few minutes. We'll be back, and Greg's going to take calls hopefully next hour, and we'll see where we go. Everyone, stay tuned. Okay, we are back for the third and final hour of Operation Scorpio. I am here with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals and Mr. Greg Felton, author, philosopher, and researcher and author of the book, The Host and the Parasite, which is a seminal work, excellent book. And, Greg, I wanted to ask you, you know, in the past, we sort of associated, you know, the corporations with, you know, with the right wing, you know, like in the 60s and 70s, the corporations were kind of right wing. And somehow they've transformed themselves into this, woke, left, so-called left wing. I don't know that those terms mean much anymore. But, you know, it seems like the corporations are coming from the left with their wokeness and political correctness and supporting Black Lives Matters and that sort of thing. So how did this transformation take place in the corporations?
Well, I don't think the corporations really changed very much. The corporations, as I said earlier, there is no such thing as a two-party state in America. Everybody is to one degree or another corporate. And the corporation is an opportunistic bacterium. It'll go anywhere it wants if it can get a profit out of it. And so corporations, now it's a little hard to say that they're all alike in every way. However, the corporation will find any place it can make a profit. So in the on what we used to call the left and the right, and you're quite right, these terms don't really apply anymore. I mean, originally they came out of the French Etat Général, where you'd have the centers would be the Democrats, moderates, and you go with the far left and far right in a circle, you would have the right wing, the far left and the far right would almost touch. And that's where the right and the left come from. But we don't have that anymore. We have essentially two right wings, which is why American politics tends to go in a circle. It just can't go straight forward anymore. So corporations will latch onto things like, say, Black Lives Matter, which started out with a good intention, but it's now been co-opted by political interest groups. And because they find ways to promote their own particular form of self-interest. I mean, there's no reason why corporations should only latch on to one party. I mean, Israel, for example, buys everybody. So they basically hedge their bets every election. Even up here in Canada, we have a nominally left-wing party called the New Democratic Party. But it's basically its head, you know, it's basically owned by Israel. It doesn't have the balls to stand up and defend Palestine, even though that's what it's supposed to do. Even the Green Party, you'd think the Green Party would have the guts. No, they're basically a bunch of small L liberals masquerading as environmentalists. So we end up with the real problem here. I mean, anybody who wants to do the right thing is frozen out, because the corporations and the interest groups buy everyone. So that's why that,
That's really true. And, you know, you've done a phenomenal amount of research on how these Zionists buy out everyone and really are puppet masters to a shocking degree. But what's your thought? It seems as though George Soros and his color revolution is being positioned as not a Zionist, but more as a Bolshevik 2.0 kind of communist movement. What are your thoughts on them positioning Soros differently?
Well, I tend not to like to use the word communist because it tends to be a little bit too polemical. I mean, you can't use the word communist without causing people basically to squirm uncomfortably in their chairs. I mean, there's no good way to talk about communism. As far as Soros goes, he's like the eminence grise behind the Democratic Party. And I do think there's a lot of influence between Soros and some of these what look like spontaneous populist movements. Up here in Canada, we had a politician complain about our former foreign minister for being close to Soros, which was a fair comment. And she was called up on the carpet for being anti-Semitic, which is a bit of a stretch. I don't know how anybody came up with that.
Right.
I mean, but I do think that there's a real problem with people who have too much money running the show in a country. The Democrats are owned, I think, to a large extent by Soros and various corporations. As far as Bolshevism, I tend not to do that. I mean, my master's degree is in Russian history. And I don't like to use Bolshevik out of context. It tends to be a little bit too ad hominem, and it doesn't really allow for deep discussion or debate, because once you use the word Bolshevik or communist, you've staked out a moral position. And if you stake out a moral position, you can't really debate it, because you're never going to want to appear to be immoral. So I would
think that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to think it best to think of Soros as perhaps an uber oligarch. When you look at the six corporations that own all the media in the United States, I mean, these are all largely owned by Jewish Zionists. They have an interest in promoting a point of view. They put out some of the most ridiculous movies for no other reason than it's just mindless fodder for the masses, or it's more Holocaust propaganda. But I would say that this is like, as I said earlier, this is like behavior control. This is oligarchic behavior. it's not necessary to go into Bolshevism or communism. This is something that's common to all powerful entities that are unaccountable to any standard beyond their own self-interest.
That's a good point. And, you know, the lines sort of start to blur between, you know, so-called communism and so-called fascism. You know, at the very top, I don't know that there's so much difference. And I see communism more or less as the lack of competition. So you have all the resources of production in the hands of the state. And that could happen in so-called communism or so-called fascism.
Well, actually, there is, as far as behavior goes, I think you're right. There's not a lot of difference. However, there is a doctrinal difference. I mean, fascists don't really believe in anything. I mean, they're just there for power. I mean, you look at Adolf Hitler. He didn't have any real great political scheme or any political design. The communists do. They do have an objective. They are coherent. They do have a function. Whether you like it or not, they are a defensible political entity. They have a belief system. They have policies. And they have an attitude toward the public. The fascist really doesn't. He doesn't really believe anything. So I think you'll find that even though there are certain behavioral similarities, I mean, at the root, they are quite different. But neither one is healthy. And, you know, there were people going back to Franklin Roosevelt, who was one of the better presidents in American history. I have to credit him with at least being an American who wanted to help his country. There were people who were calling him communist. I mean, why the hell would you do that? I mean, one of the great nonsenses of the United States in this history is that public spending or taxation to fund public projects was anathematized as somehow socialist or an invasion of one's liberty, and it was theft. And it was really, Americans have never been comfortable with the concept of public spending. And yet public spending would have saved America a lot of misery throughout its history, especially going back to the 19th century. And so Americans' society has an exaggerated affinity for individualism, and that's unhealthy. So when people do want to tax and spend money in the public interest, this should not be dismissed out of hand as a sort of a socialist invasion of democratic liberty. It should be looked upon on its merits, whether it's a good or a bad thing. I mean, one of the interesting things about the 1930s is that Franklin Roosevelt basically pushed through the Supreme Court his New Deal, many of his policies. He had to fight a lot to get a lot of the New Deal through. But at some point, the Supreme Court capitulated and said, okay, we'll let you do it. And because of that, Americans started to recover from the Great Depression. And I'm not saying all this taxation is good. A lot of it is unfortunate because many people today feel so alienated from the government. They see no benefit to paying taxes when it just gets flushed down the great toilet of government waste, or it goes to serve nefarious purposes like propping up Israel's illegitimate reign in the Middle East. But taxation is not inherently bad. But Americans will actually jump on the rhetorical bandwagon and shout communist or socialist when in fact it's perfectly consistent with conservative theory to spend in the public interest if you're going to conserve your society. And Americans never really understood. They never had a proper philosophy of government, I don't think.
See, when they were... It's very immature, very, very shallow, based on, I want to be a cowboy. This is pretty painting with broad strokes. I want to be a cowboy like John Wayne. I'm an independent man, and I'm just a break or two away from becoming a millionaire and a corporate leader. It's so unrealistic. It's like a 4-year-old playing in the sandbox thinking that anybody can be president of the United States. And the reality is, as you're saying, had the power been maintained in government for the serving the public, which, you know, even up until the late 70s, politicians still had to go home every weekend and be accountable to the senators and congressmen, to their constituents. And there was some fear about not taking care of your population. I mean, to me, if you were to say, like, somehow gut the mainstream corporate media microphone for a couple minutes, and you said, well, you know what, the Wall Street, the parasites, they're running a casino and they've stole so much money, so we're reining them in, and they're going to pay a fee now to be allowed to run this gambling. They're going to pay 10% on all options and derivatives trading, which is essentially betting on a bet, and it's all run by AI. So 10% of that is going into the public trough. And so everybody gets their health insurance. We're going to rebuild the roads. We're going to essentially give you free education. You're essentially going to get what we're doing for Israel right now. And the reaction of outrage by people, oh my God, we can't do that. You know, and yet it's such a basic good idea. But it would be resisted by those very people who it would benefit. And to me, that's just insane.
It is insane, which is why one of the things in my book I talk about, if you want to understand the United States and some of the bizarre things it's done, you have to assume an irrational frame of reference. And this is where, at the back of my book, I do cite The Matrix for this one scene in it, where we're talking about whether this is Morpheus talking to Neo about people. You see, they don't know they're in the Matrix. They think everything is normal. If you assume the United States is irrational, the world is irrational, it makes no sense, then the seemingly illogical things governments do can be explained. If you assume the world makes sense, and if you assume a rational frame of reference, then you cannot explain certain behaviors. There's right. Just no logical way to do that. So if you assume the world is nuts and you're sane, then you can at least understand why the world is the way it is. And the insanity comes from the mutation that the Zioni virus affected on the genetic makeup of the United States. Going back to Harry Truman, took his famous $2 million bribe to recognize Israel, even after he knew that Israel was massacring Palestinians, and he was thinking about rescinding his support for the partition plan of November 1947, which was on its face illegal itself. I mean, Truman was bribed.
Right.
And that Truman bribe essentially made America midwife to a war crime, a more than 7-year war crime. And that's why without the United States, Israel would not exist. So the question becomes, who is more responsible for an atrocity, the monster, Israel, or the country that made the monster possible?
Yeah, that's a great term you just used, a midwife to a war crime. That is excellent. I totally agree. Very good perspective on how powerful Israel really is over the United States and the incredible power it has and the influence. Now, I just want to let everyone know, if you want to call in, please do so. And 703-879-8880. That's 703-879-8880, or Skype me, Dolphin_Dave. So it's like the sea mammal, Dolphin_Dave, and you can get me on Skype too. Giuseppe, go ahead.
Oh, first off, like to remind people that Greg Felton has a wonderful book out, that Host and the Parasite. I'm looking right at it. I've read it a couple times, and he's working on a new book. And Greg, you had a couple other books. Would you like to briefly tell people what they're about?
I have one other book. It's called Exploding Middle East Myths. It's a compendium of essays I had written over about 15 years, looking at Israeli history, media censorship, propaganda. And there at the back, there are some satires that I wrote which I'm kind of pleased about. See, a few years ago, actually more than a few now, geez, must be about more than 15 years ago, I started to realize that the world was so bizarre that I couldn't say any more than I already had about something. So I started to write humor. I started to write satirical dialogues and mock TV shows. And I had so much fun doing it. And they take a lot of work, but sometimes you just have to do that. There's one where I did one about the former leader of the Liberal Party. This goes back quite a ways now, Michael Ignatieff, who was probably more American than he was Canadian. He didn't spend much time in Canada. And I had him go up against the Spanish Inquisition because of his apostasis for Israel. And it was great fun. He was shown the instruments of torture, which was like, we're not going to vote for you, or we're going to publish this. And he ended up capitulating to the great panel of judges that were up there. I had a lot of fun doing those. And there were some at the back of Exploding Middle East Myths that I hope the readers will appreciate. Those are the only two books. There is one other title I shan't mention because it was published over my objections. And I shan't. Basically, it's been superseded by The Host and the Parasite. So The Host and the Parasite in this third edition, which is on MoneyTreePublishing.com. This is the latest edition. It's called the Post-Obama Edition because it looks at Obama and Trump and how Trump essentially represents the culmination or like the logical conclusion of the de-intellectualization of the Republican Party that begins with Ronald Reagan. Because before Reagan, Gerald Ford was the president, the last Republican president, and he was a decent man, Ford. He doesn't get much credit for anything. He made torture illegal, by the way, contrary to he did a lot of things that most presidents, I think all presidents since him, have ignored. He was the last decent Republican to sit in the White House. And, you know, you're looking back on the nature of the United States, the Trump years represent what happens if you hollow out a party long enough so that any American who wants to work for Americans and serve American interests can be pushed out of his own party, so that everybody becomes a stooge of a foreign government. This is what you end up with. Nobody in the Republican Party that wasn't tainted by the attacks on Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. I mean, America has become America, Israel's bully boy. He's American.
Right.
America is Israel's henchman. And Americans are quite rightly, we're getting sick of this. And so, again, that is a major reason that Trump won the 2016 election. So, anyway.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so what are the conclusions you've come to about 9/11? Because it seems, you know, like hard to escape that we entered all these wars that really only benefited Israel as the result of 9/11. Where did you end up on your research with that?
Well, there's a slight error, and it's an understandable one. The September the 11th attack was not the event that caused all this.
Really?
What most people don't know is that the Patriot Act, which was essentially a broadside against the Constitution to turn the United States into a police state for corporations and Israeli aggression, was written before the event of September the 11th, at least 3 weeks before. It was drafted by Philip Zelikoff, who was the official myth maker and propagandist for the Bush junta. I don't call it a legitimate government because I stole the election from Al Gore. At any rate, the September the 11th attack was staged by the American government. It had to have been because the document that was ostensibly the product of it had already been written. We had a pre-established harmony here. We had a pre-established need to strip Americans of their civil rights And we had to have some grand, horrible act of sacred violence inflicted on the United States. So this is why the September the 11th attack was pre-organized. It had to have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed a fellow who worked in the World Trade Center, who just happened to have the Monday off, the Monday when the attack happened. And he remembers hearing people scurrying about above him. He was on about the 90th floor of one of the towers, but he knew that those floors were unoccupied. He knew that there was monkeying around with the elevators. People were. And there were people walking around in these white suits. And we also know that Marvin Bush, George's brother, who was head of security at the World Trade Center, had a stand down. The bomb sniffing dogs had been removed. There was no security. Over that weekend, events were set in motion that would lead to the destruction of the World Trade Center. So it is not possible to understand the World Trade Center in linear time. And this is why we have to assume an irrational frame of reference. It had a function. It had to rationalize the attack on the civil liberties of the United States and to rationalize the mass demonization of Muslims. I mean, Muslims had nothing to do with bringing the buildings down. Absolutely nothing. had nothing to do with it. Bin Laden knew of it. He thought it was a great idea, but he didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. And even that ridiculous 9/11 Commission report doesn't mention Bin Laden, except in one footnote, and it has nothing to do with the attack. I mean, nobody could tie him to it. It was simply asserted as some ipsa dixit nonsense. And
right.
This happened.
He made a good boogeyman.
Yeah, I suppose. But if it's, but I mean, Bin Laden died in November 2001 from kidney damage.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
But the thing is, the United States, Clinton, and others, not Clinton, I'm sorry, after the Bush government had to keep Bin Laden alive to justify massive military spending. I mean, Bin Laden was a great salesman for the Pentagon. He needed to stay alive. So we had all these phony Bin Laden sightings and bad actors pretending to be Bin Laden. It was just embarrassing. But you could tell it was a put-up job. So why would you have to do that if the man were still alive?
Right.
Sections in my book about how Bin Laden came to Afghanistan, what made him do it, and how he ended up on the outs with the royal family.
Sure, and their, you know, their family were huge contractors, military contractors, well aligned with the United States and other powerful allies. And, you know, I'll never forget on the morning of 9/11, I was drinking a coffee at the coffee shop, you know, watching the whole thing unfold. And then within an hour and a half after the buildings fell down, some intelligence guy from the CIA comes on and says, according to our intelligence, it was this guy named Osama bin Laden, and that's who did it. End of story. Within an hour of the event happening.
Yep. And that's what I wrote about also, the instant experts. They had to have been in on it so they could give the officially canned story. As a matter of fact, you're a little bit late. Within about a minute on CNN or Fox, you had some instant expert saying, well, we had this pancaking effect because the planes hit the building and the weight of the planes pushed all the floors down.
The Harley Davidson guy, right?
Yeah, the guy at the Harley Davidson t-shirt.
It might have, I don't know who it was, but I forget.
Yeah, that gave him street cred.
It was so conspicuous. I mean, how did
Hold on, Greg. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back and we'll talk about the Harley guy some more. Just an average guy on the street. Be right back. Okay, we're back here on Operation Scorpio, and we're on the final half hour. This show has really whipped by. We're having a great conversation here with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals and Greg Felton. And right before the bottom of the hour, Greg had brought up the Harley guy, the guy with the Harley Davidson t-shirt and a baseball cap. And lo and behold, he knew exactly the physics of what happened with that building within minutes of it collapsing. Why don't you continue, Greg? That was great.
Yeah, this, you know, what I found really bizarre about the Trade Center is that how informed people were so quickly, because you had to know this was a cooked operation. But nobody challenged him. And the interviewer was in on it, too. I can't say for certain, but I'm pretty sure he was told by his producer, go find this guy in the Harley chair and go talk to him. But he had to have been a plant. This is why it's important to understand the mentality of the Edward Bernays School of Propaganda. I mean, you have to have people there to sell the point of view. You've got to have people selling the lie, and it has to sound believable. And you have somebody in a Harley shirt, I mean, in a bald cap. He looks like some ordinary Joe off the street. So he has this credibility. He doesn't look like a plant, but he looks like a normal guy. And this was if looking at it from the propagandist point of view, it was a smart thing to do. Because this is how you end up selling a lie. You have people that can package it in a way that makes it palatable to the masses. And the average person is so easily manipulated by things that he thinks are real. I mean, the sense of sight is the most easily tricked of all the five senses. And this is why when we saw those aircraft, we don't even, A, know there were any aircraft, whether that wasn't CGI. And I'm not going to commit to this. I don't know. But what's interesting is that if you looked at the South Tower, and you had the ABC News had this very interesting set of freeze frames of this aircraft, of the aircraft striking the building, and you can see before the nose of the airplane even touches the outside wall of the building, there are explosions going off on the line of sight of that aircraft.
Hey, excuse me, guys. I got something I can play for you. Here's the Harley guy.
Watch the planes hit the towers. I watched my roommate's truck place minutes after the first plane had hit. I saw this plane come out of nowhere and just scream into the Twin Tower, exploding through the other side. And then I witnessed both towers collapse, one first and then the second, due to structural failure because the fire was just too intense.
Obviously, there were a lot of people inside the buildings at the time.
From the 7th Precinct.
Oh, my God.
Awesome clip, Giuseppe.
What's funny about that is that an airplane is largely a floating beer can, right? It's a flying beer can. It's made of aluminum and lightweight metal. Otherwise, it would never take off. The World Trade Centers were built in the early 1970s, late 60s. They were steel-reinforced concrete with asbestos insulation, which was at the time not a good thing. So you've got to ask yourself, if a beer can runs into steel, what do you think is going to happen to the beer can? Well, it's going to crumple. It's not going to go through the building out the other side. That's physically impossible. So this guy was reading a script, obviously. He was just spouting it as fast as he could, and he was trained to do it. And the Fox News idiot didn't have the wherewithal to challenge him on it, or probably was told not to. I mean, the whole official story of September the 11th is so indefensible. It's like trying to believe that the coronavirus is natural. It's not defensible, but it's the lie that we're supposed to believe. And the liars won the day on September the 11th. Now, I would submit, I think 2/3 of Americans today don't believe the official story. And I think more than that don't believe that Oswald shot Kennedy. So, I mean, the lies, unfortunately, are not officially repudiated, so they still persist, even though people don't believe them.
Greg, I have a question in the realm of lies, which first cousin oxymoron. What do you make of the oxymoron Christian Zionist?
Oh, that's not an oxymoron.
It's not?
The Christians believe that, well, actually, hang on a second. Well, let me think about that for a second. Christian Zionists have no use for Jews whatsoever. They think Jews will suffer for 1,000 years while all the good Christians will get raptured up to heaven by Jesus when he sends his limo down. A Christian Zionist finds common cause with Jewish Zionists because they both mutually hate Muslims. And the Christian Zionist, again, this has to do a lot with Judeophilia, which is, you know, where people, Jews are very powerful, they're very influential, and they can do a lot, and they're very wealthy to a large degree. Not all, of course, but to a large degree, a lot of them are. So the Christian Zionists find that there's sort of a common cause between them and the Jews, who both believe that the Jews should go into Israel. A lot of Christians hate Jews. They want to get rid of them. They want to offload them from whatever country they're in to sit and to go to Israel. That's a lot of what made a lot of Englishmen, for example, pro-Israel. They wanted to offload their Jews. You are right to a degree. It is an oxymoron in that there is no affection for Jews among Christian Zionists, but they have a common purpose.
Hello, are we still there?
I think so. Are you still there?
Oh, okay, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm still here. Okay, okay.
You just cut off there for a second.
Oh,
okay. Uncomfortable silence there.
That's right. Well, my next question is, how do you see the amazing 9/11 psychological operation, or rather, should I say, did it lay the groundwork for the even larger COVID-19 psychological operation?
No, I don't see any connection whatever. I don't think you have to really stretch reality to force a connection. No, I think it's not fruitful to do that.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
No, you see, the COVID-19 comes from, see, a lot of the gene splicing that took place happened in the 2000s. Let me see. This happened largely afterwards. I mean, going around to 2005, there were some beginnings of the manipulation. I mean, let's face it, germ warfare has been going on for a long time. This is just a relatively recent manifestation of germ warfare.
And well, Greg, couldn't you make one kind of similarity? Is that they both are based on trauma in order to manipulate the general masses into acquiescing into something that they wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, but you would have to show that there would be a common purpose to this. Again, this is one of those speculative questions that sounds really interesting, but it can't be demonstrated. And if people, you know, go on about just sort of trying to force equations between things that are radically dissimilar, and they can't back it up with evidence, then it becomes kind of sterile. I mean, you can keep mentioning it and keep arguing it, but if you can't go into it in any detail or show any cause and effect, then it doesn't really amount to anything. I don't think it helps either, because there are people who can simply say, I just don't agree with you, or where's your evidence? And if you can't produce it, then you've lost the argument. I would prefer to see the SARS-CoV-2 virus kept within the realm of malicious science in the name either of biowarfare or just financial self-interest. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars at stake in promoting these viruses and manufacturing. I mean, the idea that you can do this is not new. This is old technology almost. So you have to ask, you should be asking, why are we even doing this? I mean, what is the purpose of it? And look at it on its merits. If you later on can find that there is a connection, great, I'd love to read it. But unless you can prove it, it's a little hard to sustain.
Sure, but it is certainly convenient that who's the beneficiary from this? It's certainly the corporations that have access to magic shekels from the central banks and that are closely aligned with the government. Small businesses are being left out to flap in the wind for the most part.
Well, then your position is that the COVID virus is simply a mechanism by which the United States or the world, it wants to destroy small businesses so that everybody can be grouped together into massive corporate super businesses. I guess that might be a consequence of it, but I'm not sure that I can accept that without some more research. I mean, that may be the effect of it. I mean, but why? I mean, what's the purpose? I mean, why would you want to put small businesses out of business? I mean, well, you need to find a motive here. You have to find a really nefarious, malicious, inhuman motive. And I haven't found that yet. I mean, there's a people who think, like Andy Meng believes, that China deliberately released the virus. And that's a point of view shared by many people. I just don't understand what the motive was. Like, I can't see that connection between motive and opportunity. Now, in my research, I have found that there has been decades of sloppy, inefficient, incompetent control of pathogens. Fort Detrick, Maryland leaks like a sieve. The CDC headquarters in Atlanta had lost material. This is back in 2014, I think. June or July, there was lost of material for the CDC. So how do you do this? How do you lose material? And I've got a list of about, I don't know, dozens of accidents that have happened of various types throughout the United States. So the idea of a lab leak, an accidental lab leak, is certainly within the realm of possibility, especially since the Beijing laboratories had notoriously been found to be leaking. And in fact, the United States State Department got so upset with this that they demanded accountability from Beijing labs before they would allow their people to work there. I mean, you had also this place not far from the Hainan Market, which is a laboratory affiliated with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And what was going on there is that lab animals, after they had been used for laboratory purposes, were sold to the market for human consumption. I mean, this is insane. I mean, there were people there who had been bitten by bats, who had been peed on by bats, and the idea that a pathogen could accidentally leak from a lab is certainly credible. It's a better story than one that says it was done deliberately, because the deliberate release one doesn't have evidence. And it's kind of important to hold back one's enthusiasm until one can support an argument. Because once you can support it, then you've got something, which is why I'm taking a long time to write this book. I'm having to research and re-research and reevaluate points of view just to make sure I don't make any errors. And the problem with the SARS virus is that a lot of it is unknown. And we don't have any, we don't know from the people who were actually working on the virus what happened on that day. Because what we also know is there was something peculiar happening in October of 2019. There were some very strange illnesses among certain people working in laboratories. It's often thought that the virus leaked out of the Wuhan lab long before we were told. And there was a case where there was this one, I think it was a woman who was working in the laboratory. She got infected and she took this long train trip down to the south of China. And she didn't even know she was infected. There was another PhD candidate, PhD postgrad researcher. He also got infected about two 2.5 weeks later. But this is in October. But we weren't told there was anything wrong until December 31st, 2019, or January 1st, or something. This is when the World Health Organization made its announcement. And it did so at the behest of China that reported it, but it's not clear. It's not clear that that was the first outbreak. So if, in fact, the October outbreaks were the first instances of release of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, then we have to conclude it was an accident. It wasn't deliberate. So trying to ascribe motive is very different, very difficult, unless you can really be confident, and it's not just wishful thinking.
I definitely think that what you're describing is, you know, Occam's razor. Like, the budget wasn't big enough, so they maintained the lab at level 2 viral security when it should have been level 3 or level 4, and all of a sudden all the lab people are getting sick and die a few years later. I think that that is absolutely realistic and does happen. But on the other hand, the United States spends $500 billion with a T annual budget on bioweapons, and again, the vaccine industry is indemnified against being sued for malicious behavior. So don't you think that's a dangerous combination?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I can show evidence that both Chinese and Americans were rushing to patent anything coming out of SARS-CoV-2 research, which means there's a lot of money to be made at this. And the idea that this is designed to manufacture gazillions of dollars for vaccine companies does seem to be a plausible theory. And I say that it needs to be investigated. I'm getting sick to death of Bill Gates promoting himself as the savior of mankind.
No kidding.
And it just makes me ill. And, I mean, he actually came up with some TED Talk. He talked about some upcoming pandemic. So judging from the comments from certain people, it is realistic to speculate that somehow this might have been planned.
But sure, and then we've got the lockstep documents from the Rockefeller Institute, and then Event 201 as well as correlating evidence.
What interests me, though, is something that I don't think anybody else knows, but I found in search. I don't know if you know of a man named Joe Courtney. He's a rather nondescript congressman from Connecticut. Never heard of him. He's probably spent his whole life just doing his normal congressional business. He's been elected about 8 times or something. So he's got a great career. In January 2019, this is January 2019, approximately, 11 and a half months before we heard about COVID virus, he sponsors a bill in the House, in the Congress, called the CARES Act, which came to be known as the act by which the American government would give financial aid to people suffering from the coronavirus. The question is, why would the CARES Act be introduced into Congress 11 months before it was needed?
That is a good question.
I left a message with his office. I never heard back. I didn't expect to. But it looks kind of strange. I know. Was there an expectation there was going to be an outbreak of some pathogen? I don't know. It's one of those weird, sort of unexplainable. But why would he do this? Did the Americans plan for this? I mean, I can see why speculation runs rampant because of things like this. And I fully understand it.
Do you think that it's intentional to have speculation run rampant, because that creates such a dense, foggy layer of subterfuge that you're never going to figure out what they're really doing?
That's a good point. Yes, I think that's one of the things that propagandists rely on. They want to muddy the waters. They don't want the public to focus on what really goes on. So they love people who sort of go off on tangents and think about weird things that otherwise, you know, are implausible. I think that this is what gets me when we have.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Wait, Greg, we've got a caller here. I don't mean to cut you off, but we've only got about 7 minutes left. So let's get the caller's question in for you. Go ahead, caller. Steve, go ahead.
Hello, it's Steve from the UK, Glastonbury. You've just been talking about how Israel took over America and obviously how in the UK that's probably gone the same under the guise of Boris Johnson. But when we talk about like the paymasters and what their immediate short-term plans are, as in from right now to the next year, how do you feel Mossad and Israel are manipulating the Federal Reserve in terms of monetary policy, like MMT, to move the whole West in a direction, say, what, towards conflict with Russia? Or is this just going to be a gradual demise of the West and then we're just going to see the rise of the East through Rothschild investments and the new world order of the BRICS countries? I mean, how do you see that playing out and what's the catalyst in the short term of how they, where they've moved the money? Obviously, people like Black Lives Matter have had a lot of money put into them by George Soros. But is there anything else you can see, like financially, where the money's being moved and who's moving that money that we should be on the lookout for in the next year? I mean, that's kind of how I want to phrase it to you.
Wow, that changes gears quite radically. As far as the Federal Reserve goes, I don't think Mossad has to worry too much about that because America has already been housebroken. I mean, the Federal Reserve is run by banks, private banking cartel, and most of these banks are run by pro-Israeli Jews. So I don't think there's really any problem for Mossad. I do think you bring up a very interesting point, though, about the future of the United States. I mean, a virus will assume its host until the host dies. And so it's quite realistic to expect that Israel might be looking for other nations to colonize, to be the next great, you know, seat that it can just sort of suck dry.
Indeed, they've mentioned Ukraine on that. But just focusing on the money for a second, if the Treasury is telling the Fed that with the latest tranche of money, you've got to directly monetize that, say with the new FedNow payment system, which they want to roll out and replace SWIFT, surely it's the Treasury which is telling the Fed what to do. And if Mossad controls that through sexual black ops or bribery or however, they're able to control the printing of the money directly, a foreign agent of a foreign power. So the question is, if Mossad isn't taking the Fed, but perhaps takes the Treasury that controls the Fed through directly legislating financial power to the Treasury from Congress or whoever, you know, controlled by AIPAC, is there not like a threat that America's own money supply, the Federal Reserve Note, is being used for foreign policy effects, which would draw us into a terminal decline if nothing is done?
Well, yes, but the thing is, the Treasury is an agency of the federal government, or is a federal institution. The Federal Reserve is a private cartel, so I don't think the Federal Reserve has to worry too much about the Treasury. The Department of Treasury may make policy, but it's the Jews who run the banks that run the cartel that basically control the money supply. And as you remember, this came out of the 1920s or so when there was a stampede in New York. When there was a J.P. Morgan engineered a panic demand for the public to demand a Federal Reserve, a central banking system, because he faked that there was a run on some New York bank.
Because the MMT crowd do seem to think they can get the Treasury to print off any amount of COVID money now. That's the almost the vehicle in which MMT policy is being introduced. It was going to be under an environmental catastrophe and measures, but really the COVID has been the more urgent vehicle with which to move that, the MMT crowd via the Treasury. So they are targeting the Treasury. Obviously, I don't know if that's going to be successful or not and what the results of that are, but I just wanted to throw that out there to link that MMT theory with people pushing for the Treasury to actually get the Fed to do the monetizing of the debt, maybe through a digital dollar to people's mobile Obama phones.
Obama phones. This is not area of my expertise, actually, but I'm thinking because the Fed is so independent, I don't know why it needs to worry about the Treasury.
I think they're trying to buy the world. I think they're going to literally try and buy the whole world in the next crisis, and that next tranche of COVID stimulus money is what everyone is hanging on. Not really the election. The election is a distraction. It's a dog and pony show. It's when the next large tranche of money, which dwarfs the last amount, is going to be printed. And that's what all the eyes are on. And MMT does seem to be the vehicle with COVID to introduce that, I think.
It is an interesting theory. And I think that's quite a... It is a possibility. But I think if the Fed tries to buy the world, I think you might end up with
buyer's remorse. I actually do think they're going to try and monetize $40 trillion and try and move that around the world and introduce the Fed micromanaging everybody's lives regardless of borders or law.
Yes, Steve, great call. We're at the end of the show here. We've only got a closing moment here. Greg, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. I really like your method of thinking and your exactness in high standards for proof for something that's excellent. And I hope you can come on the show again sometime soon and continue this conversation.
I'd love to. By the way, your listeners should go to modestypublishing.com to get my book.
Okay, that's it, guys. Thanks a lot. Until next week.